This is Jim Inkster. Today we begin our show, Talk Louisiana, with a Louisiana legend, Jim Taylor, Pro Football Hall of Famer, the pride of Baton Rouge, and he started LSU in 1956. 1957, he led the Southeastern Conference in scoring, and he went on to a brilliant career with the Green Bay Packers, 9 years, four titles with Vince Lombardi's Packers, and then in the year of 1967, Jim Taylor came home and became an inaugural member of the New Orleans Saints, and the Saints began their regular season journey September 17th, 1967, 50 years ago this Sunday. 50 years ago to the day, Jim Taylor and Danny Abramowitz and many others were on the field as the Saints teed it up against the Los Angeles Rams. New Orleans was coached by Tom Fears. Rams were coached by George Allen and had some of the greatest players of that era in Roman Gabriel and Rosie Greer and many others. And the Rams won 27-13 at Tulane Stadium. Full house, more than 80,000 people on hand that day. And the game opened, Jim Taylor, in the most unusual way. It certainly was an auspicious start for the Saints. You recall John Gilliam?
Yes, I do, yeah. That was outstanding. Just wonderful to christen the first game of the Saints, their home game. We'd played a couple exhibition games, and him taking it all the way back, 100, took it out of the end zone, I think, and brought it all the way to the other end zone, and it christened the game.
Well, Jim Taylor is about to celebrate birthday number 82. He was born in 1935, and his much younger and beautiful wife, Helen, is here. And Helen and Jim have been together a long time, but they met in Baton Rouge, where Jim Taylor was a hero long before he even played for LSU. You had quite a start at Baton Rouge High, didn't you?
Yes, I did, yeah. And Baton Rouge Junior High and Baton Rouge High, which I'd been, playing basketball and things at the YMCA and bouncing the ball and catching, and trying to get into the basketball business at Baton Rouge High School and played, and then we got into football and a little baseball and in the summertime, so.
Well, and it's been a lifetime passion for Jim Taylor to stay in shape, and he is a survivor of a stroke 13 years ago. And Helen, you've been at his side, and what an amazing recovery. He was truly near death 13 years ago.
He was. Our neighbor saw him running in our neighborhood and called 911, and Jim was actually paralyzed on his left side, and he was totally out in the emergency room at the lake. We got the neurosurgeon there, and he gave him the TPA shot. And I actually witnessed a miracle. A couple hours later, he was just back to normal, the normal old Jimmy. But it was very frightening, and he was in that three-hour window to get that TPA shot. And it's so important if you have a stroke to get to the hospital in time.
And he played 10 years at the highest level of the National Football League, football your whole life, and you took and also inflicted quite a few headshots along the way. Jim, a lot of your colleagues have had problems. This is something that is real, and is it a concern for you that you certainly delivered and received a number of big hits during your career?
Yes, and I feel so-so, but I'm still going in and trying to be checked with the National Football League doctors and things here in the next, hopefully, the next few months.
Will you donate your brain to science when you die? Have you decided one way or the other?
We hadn't discussed that at this point, yeah.
But in your day, the head was used as a weapon, wasn't it? Both offensively and defensively.
Well, yeah, but I tried to get into a position when I was meeting tacklers down with my shoulders and forearms and things and protect myself even along the sidelines, which why I wasn't going to step out of bounds. I was going to try and get as much yardage. I wasn't going to give up and step out like I see some players today do. So it's just that, you want to be a team person with the Green Bay Packers and be their best running back and best productivity type player.
You never shied away from contact, did you? You invited it.
I invited it, absolutely. Well, if you're going to have it, then you prepare yourself and initiate it instead of receive it. Does that make a lot of sense?
A lot of sense. But a running back is usually a fair game because you're the one being tackled. But you viewed it as an opportunity when somebody was coming at you.
Right. I had the ball, too, and you had to secure that in the left hand. And I used more of the right hand to the forearms and the things and dropping down and trying not to let the tackles get a shot at your legs where your power is and where your strength is in a crouch position.
You were known and may still very well be regarded as the most physical ball carrier in the history of the game. Who were some of the guys you came across on the defensive side who were just as physical as you were?
Well, Sam Huff and all your middle linebackers and other tackles and Alex Karras and different other players that played the game and were very aggressive and tough. And it was just you were delighted when you had to compete against the best of the best.
Is it true you occasionally bit players?
I don't think so. I don't think that was possible whatsoever with that mask on and the two bars in front of your face there from the helmet. So, no, that didn't happen. This got out some kind of way in my early career, and it's carried on through the end of it here at my retirement. I'm still defending myself, and never, ever, ever did I bite anybody.
1976, Jim Taylor was the first of Vince Lombardi's Green Bay Packers to be inducted in the Pro Football Hall of Fame, 41 years ago. How many are in there now from those teams? It's well over 10, isn't it?
I think so. Is it right at the top of the – I'm not quite sure the exact
so
amount.
So you were with some of the greatest players in the history of the game. I hear Bart Starr is having some issues. Your quarterback.
He is, yeah. He's had a stroke and a heart attack and some other issues and things, and he's really struggling. My wife may can add to that.
Well, when you had your Packers reunion a few years ago, I'm told that you were the only guy who ran on the field. Is that right?
I'm not sure. I don't recall, but I'm still active here.
Well,
I get to the health club and enjoy in the neighborhood to maybe pick up a little pace and get my heart rate up and try and train a little bit to a level of conditioning to have a better lifestyle.
Yeah, I see you regularly at the Spectrum, usually early in the morning. Jim Taylor is a guy who has always been dedicated to physical fitness. Do you think that's the reason you had the success you did?
Probably so. I just enjoyed competition, and I started this at Baton Rouge High School, I think, when I was a ninth grader, when I made the varsity team, the basketball team, and getting you moving to the next level of competitive, get excited, and excel, going right on to the top.
At Baton Rouge High, Jim Taylor was an All-American football player and basketball player. I think you're the only guy ever to play in both All-American games in both sports at the same school.
Yeah.
So it was quite a start for you, and you naturally went to LSU. Had a paper route, didn't you, as a kid?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That was a good way to stay in shape. I hear our president had a paper route and threw the papers from a limo. You weren't throwing from a limo, were you?
No, I was throwing from a bicycle.
Yeah. And that's why you have those powerful, powerful legs. Is that where the real strength comes for a running back? You have strong upper body, but you got to have those legs, right?
You do, and you got to have the hips and the where you can drop down and explode. And different runners have different styles and things, but you need those good, strong, powerful legs to excel as a running back.
Is Wendell Harris still alive, your former LSU
I'm not sure.
Teammate? Well, he had a good NFL career with the Colts and some other teams. But
yeah.
He told a story once. I'm going to tell it. He said that once he was running up and down the stairs at Tiger Stadium in the off season, Mm-hmm. And he sees you down at the bottom of the stadium, ramming your backside into the wall of Tiger Stadium. Boom, boom, boom. And he said, Jim, he comes down, what are you doing? And your line was, I got the toughest butt in the business. That's important for a running back, too, isn't it?
Well, I don't know. You might have had some spooky cliches and beliefs in some of those early years.
Well, Jim Taylor is a Louisiana legend and recently went to the Vatican. That was heady stuff, right?
Yeah, it was. We got invited there by the Pro Football Hall of Fame. About six players went, and we were there visiting and taking pictures and talk. Well, the Pope has an interpreter, so we were there, more pictures and visiting and things, and went to some different functions for about a week.
Well, we'll get Helen's take on that as well. Helen Taylor, the beautiful wife of Jim Taylor, is in the studio along with the Pro Football Hall of Famer from LSU. LSU's only had three, Jim Taylor, Y.E. Tittle, and Steve Van Buren. 877-217-5757 is your number. Back in 90 seconds on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us. 877-217-5757 is your number for Talk Louisiana. Locally, 297-5633. And you can email us talk@talklouisiana.org. Jim Taylor is with us, the LSU great, who's a Pro Football Hall of Famer. And he's with his lovely wife, Helen. And they are here to talk for another segment. Once again, your number, 877-217-5757. The hook today for Jim Taylor was that 50 years ago this Sunday, he was on the field for the Saints in their first game ever, first regular season game at Sugar Bowl Stadium or Tulane Stadium, and that it was bedlam, wasn't it? It was like Tiger Stadium on a Saturday night. What was that experience like, being there for the inaugural game?
Well, it was exciting. I'd been with the Packers for 8 or 9 years, and I came home back to Louisiana and joined the expansion team, the New Orleans Saints, where John Meacham Jr. brought the team to New Orleans. And so I was delighted to be back in the state of Louisiana and playing a ball game.
But it's tough being on an expansion team. And here you were leaving the best team in football. You just won the first Super Bowl, Jim Taylor scoring in the 35-10 win over Kansas City in Super Bowl I. And yet you made the decision to come home to Louisiana. Why did you do that?
Well, I think probably just to come back home and do after the retirement of being the running back, then I got into radio color and scouting for the New Orleans Saints. I'd go to other different schools and colleges and write up reports on players that they may look to get in the draft to bring to the New Orleans Saints team.
And as I noted, you were first of the Packers to be inducted in the Pro Football Hall of Fame 41 years ago. And Jim Taylor, along with Helen and a few other NFL greats, went to the Vatican just a few months ago. Helen, that was a once-in-a-lifetime experience.
It was, Jim. It was an absolute once-in-a-lifetime experience. Jim and I have met presidents. We've met prime ministers. But meeting the Pope has to be the icing on the cake. I think they had told us that the Pro Football Hall of Fame was the first American sports organization to have the private audience with Pope Francis. And it was just so special. There were seven Hall of Famers and their wives and the board of directors and their families. And Jim and I actually got to shake Pope Francis's hand and speak with him. I told Pope Francis my name, and I told him that I was from Louisiana and that we were praying for him, and we asked him to pray for us. We had been flooded, and that we asked him to pray and bless our city of Baton Rouge, and he just squeezed my hand and smiled, and it was just such a special moment.
Yeah, I'm sure it was. 877-217-5757 and talk@talklouisiana.org. A couple of questions from listeners. Jim, Thomas wants to know your relationship with Bill Kilmer, who was the first Saints quarterback, a running back converted to a quarterback. Number 17, Billy Kilmer, who threw more end-over-end passes than anybody in the history of the game, but he got the job done, didn't he?
Yes, he did. Yeah, he was quite a guy, and we were very knows his wife and him, and you know, and we're still friends. And Billy went on to be an outstanding quarterback and a good guy. So we've still have a friendship.
And like Helen, his wife is a flight attendant.
Right. I think one of the funniest things Billy told us at the 50-year reunion last year with the New Orleans Saints is that when he came from UCLA to the New Orleans Saints, he couldn't believe how hot and how humid it was in Louisiana. And he says, "My God, the mosquitoes were bigger than me on the practice fields." But he told some really funny stories at the reunion, as all the guys did last year. And we just had a ball with John Gilliam and Billy Kilmer and Danny Abramovich and all the guys. It was really special.
Now, his wife has been a flight attendant for more than 50 years.
She has. Sandy and I flew together. I flew for 34 with Delta Airlines. And when Jim had his stroke 13 years ago, I really didn't need to be in Istanbul or Paris or London. I need to be home with my husband. So I retired after 34 years. But Sandy's been flying over 50 years. And she flies. She's based in Miami with Delta. She's done the top five out of 20,000 Delta flight attendants.
I would imagine flight attendants know football players pretty well. You encounter them along the way. And I'm going to guess their reputations are not that great. So when you meet Jim Taylor, one of the greats of the great, you probably thought, "Oh, no way, I want to be with that guy."
That's what we were discussing. I told him I had flown a lot of the charters when I lived in Houston, the Houston Oilers and the Astros and different baseball and football and different charters, and it just wasn't. They made a lot of money, and they all thought they were so great. And when Jim told me he didn't make any money, I thought, well, that's interesting. And he told me he actually had a college degree. I thought, well, that's even better. So anyway, 35 years later, things have worked out.
I think so. Question from Scott Clemens to Jim Taylor. Which Packer team was the best, in your opinion? You were on four title teams. Which one was the best?
Well, all of them, you know, were competitive. And well, I don't know. Well, 1962, when we won, I guess.
You were the NFL MVP that year.
That year, okay. Yeah. Well, that was probably my bigger best year. And then, you know, and I had, Lombardi came, and he really, you know, got the players to play and his leadership and him, you know, from the New York Giants and been up with, like, Tom Landry with other teams and you know, so we, you know, got the players to play and to be productive for the next four or 5 years, and then playing in the first Super Bowl against the Kansas City Chiefs. My good friend Johnny Robinson was on there, and Lenny Dawson and different other players, where they merged the leagues, so the AFL joined with the NFL.
1962, Jim Taylor, NFL MVP, and that's quite an honor. And I'm looking that year, 19 touchdowns in 14 games, 14-game season then, 1,474 yards. That's pretty strong. Mm-hmm. Another listener, Hal, asks about your friendship with Pete Maravich. You got to know him pretty well.
We did. We were neighbors there. In
New Orleans.
In New Orleans, yes. We lived right across the street from each other. And we used to go to a little local tennis club there and play tennis, and we became very good friends, and Bob Pettit was down there in our neighborhood also. But Pete and I were—he was such a competitor and a great, great guy.
I would imagine when you were playing tennis, it wasn't a leisurely activity. But both of you guys are extremely competitive.
Absolutely, yeah. And he became real dear friends with me there since we were neighbors, and he was in his prime.
Can you believe it, though, that he died at 40?
Yeah.
Dropped dead playing basketball.
Yeah. It's just, you know, situations with athletes and whatever and other different athletes and things, you know, passed on.
As far as the LSU pedigree, how much did your experience here mean as far as the success you were later to have?
You mean with
You played for Paul Dietzel. The teams you were on were not the great teams, but you were a great player on an average team. By the way, he scored every point in his final game at LSU. LSU player to do that. One of the few times in college football it's happened.
The Tulane Green Wave.
Was that that experience, was that the catalyst for everything else?
Well, And then I played some defense too, you know, at that time with LSU and at that level, you know. And I enjoyed that, playing some middle linebacker and things, and carrying the ball and being able to receive and just being productive overall for the team.
Well, Jim Taylor did it all. Looks like he could still play. 50 years ago this Sunday, he was the starting running back for the Saints in Game 1, September 17, 1967. Great to see you, Jim. It looks like you could still play. And thanks for being with him, Helen. It's great to see you as well. Monday we'll be talking about what happened with the pledge at LSU. Max Groover of Roswell, Georgia, 18 years old, dead in what may have been a hazing incident, and there is an investigation ongoing. So we will discuss that Monday on this program. And a tragedy last night near the gates of LSU on Alaska Street, an employee of more than 20 years at Louis Cafe, Donald Smart, killed, shot to death as he was walking to work in the shadows of Tiger Stadium. We'll be back with Mike McIntyre, the New York Times Pulitzer Prize winner. His book is Champion's Way, Florida Football, Florida, and the Lost Soul of College Sports. Now the news with Karen Henderson on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster, and our guest is Mike McIntyre, Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter at the New York Times. He teaches journalism at New York University, and his reporting on corruption in college sports for the Times was a Pulitzer finalist. His book is Champion's Way, Football, Florida, and the Lost Soul of College Sports. Good morning, Mike McIntyre.
Morning, Jim. Thanks for having me.
Before we get to what happened at Florida State, which is a big part of your book, you go all the way back to the early days of college football, and the inception of the sport on college campuses is much different than we know it now. How much different?
Well, it's interesting. It's different, and yet it's not so much different. One of the things I discovered in my research was an essay written by the president of Duke University, who was expressing concern about growing commercialism in college sports and the role of money and the corrosion of academic standards. And he wrote that in 1906. So I was struck by how many of the problems that we see today that are behind a lot of the scandals we read about in the headlines have been there since the inception. I mean, originally, yes, it was a sport, football in particular, that was relegated to just the Ivy League schools, and then it kind of spread, you know, from there. And they took some steps during the Teddy Roosevelt era to protect the physical toll that, you know, stopped that took on athletes. But some underlying issues involving commercialism and money and just the whole business nature of it kind of remained undealt with. I think that's part of what's probably behind a lot of the problems that we see today.
Well, in many cases, including the place where we are in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, the football program, the LSU Tigers, that's the biggest brand in the city, if not the whole state of Louisiana. What problems, if any, does that inherently cause a university?
I think that part of the issue here is that the university presidents have kind of fallen under this spell that if they have a big-time athletic program, it will bring with it lots of tangential benefits. You know, certainly in some cases it raises the profile of a school, that's without a doubt. And in a very few cases, at the very upper top of the Division I, you do get some, you know, monetary benefits from it. But by far, most universities and colleges lose money on their athletic programs. Even the ones that are, you know, that take in over $100 million a year, they don't break even because they spend a lot of money to maintain these programs. And so it's a little bit of a conundrum as to how this came to be and whether or not, you know, the attraction to it just remains it's a cultural thing, certainly, in a lot of places. I mean, look, I'm a sports fan. I love watching college games, football and basketball. But at some level, you know, you do have to wonder whether or not, you know, the priorities on a college campus are a little bit skewed when, you know, you have so much emphasis on the athletic side to the point where, in order to keep some of these athletes eligible to play, they end up cutting corners. That leads to academic scandals. It spreads all the way down into the surrounding communities where you have local cops or perhaps doing side jobs, working on, you know, game day, and they wind up having to investigate an athlete. And oftentimes, as we've seen, you know, those investigations don't happen or they're minimized. So that there's a lot of insidious sort of, you know, byproducts to this, which I think a lot of people just don't want to faith.
We're talking with Mike McIntyre, Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter at the New York Times. His book is Champion's Way, Football, Florida, and the Lost Soul of College Sports. Before we get to Florida State, is it a problem in other sports, not just football, as far as the emphasis and the perhaps the temptation to do wrong?
Well, we've certainly seen it with men's basketball. You don't have to look very far, even today, at Louisville, you know, where there was a scandal there which led to the suspension of the men's basketball coach that involved other people working for the program who were hiring strippers to attract recruits. I mean, nobody can look at that and think that's what should be happening in a college sports program. So, again, I think whether it's basketball or football, you have to come back to why these things continue to happen. And when you've got $8 or $9 billion a year coming in through the Division I sports programs collectively, those are high stakes. And I think it affects the thinking and decision-making all the way from the university president on down to the athletes on the field. And there's a strong impetus there to not rock the boat and try to keep things on even keel just because the stakes are so high financially.
At Florida State, the football coach is Jimbo Fisher. If reports are accurate, he almost was hired at LSU 2 years ago. That did not happen. He was a former assistant involved with both national championship teams of recent vintage as the offensive coordinator for the Tigers. But he's had his issues at Florida State, and many of them swirling about his great quarterback, Jameis Winston. This case was a national story. It's still talked about, and you write about it compellingly. There's still some unanswered questions, aren't there?
Well, his case, which primarily involved an allegation, as we know, of rape, for which he was never charged, ended, I think, in many ways inconclusively, which is part of the reason why he continues to be a subject of fascination and concern. In my book, I do take another look at this and learn some new things. There was a lawsuit against him by his accuser, which was settled, and he gave a deposition in that case, which was never made public, and I was able to learn some things from that he was asked about in terms of his dealings with other women while he was at Florida State. And, there was some very concerning things that happened just with the conclusion of the criminal investigation. One of the prosecutors involved said publicly, which is kind of extraordinary, that while she thought there was not enough evidence to convict Winston at that late date, she also was not convinced that he was innocent. And so there are things there which I think we're never going to know the answer to, because the time to do a proper investigation was when the complaint was made, and the Tallahassee Police Department just completely screwed it up. They didn't do a proper investigation in that case.
And Mike, you note other challenges at FSU involving academic misconduct.
Yeah, and one of the things which I reveal in the book, been out before, is the case of a teaching assistant named Christina Suggs, who was also a doctoral candidate, a doctoral student in education, and she tried to blow the whistle on what she saw as academic malfeasance in hospitality classes. These are online courses that athletes were kind of funneled into at the school, and she presented to the authorities at the school evidence of what certainly appears to be plagiarism and breaks being given to the players that other students were not getting. And the school says they investigated this by turning it over to an outside law firm, which concluded there were no NCAA violations. So it doesn't appear this was ever reported to the NCAA. There was never any public mention of it. The whistleblower in this case ended up losing her teaching assistant job and leaving the school. So, it's a pretty damning case, and unfortunately, Florida State has a bit of a history here, because a similar thing happened 10 years ago, for which they end up vacating 12 victories. It was a similar academic scandal.
And you say that college sports has become a multi-billion dollar industry that skirts federal taxes. How so?
One of the things that fascinated me in this case, in doing my research on this, was to learn that all of this money which flows into the system does so tax-free. And that's because the athletic programs are part of the tax-exempt educational institution. So all of the billions of dollars that come in through the NCAA and into the athletic conferences and the schools themselves escapes taxation. And you really have to kind of ask yourself, is that something that should be subsidized by the public? They seem to be very lucrative commercial enterprises. And there's a school of thought that if you take some of the wind out of the sails of the money that's behind a lot of these problems, that it might help reform the system. So maybe taking a look at the tax exemption that college athletics is afforded right now would be one step in that direction.
And all of these big football powers have private foundations, corporate funders, booster groups. It's part of the process. That's what's necessary to stay competitive. How have they changed the landscape?
That was another thing which struck me was the power and influence of boosters, who are often wealthy individuals and organizations and companies that like to support sports programs at the schools. And to take Florida State again as an example, the Florida State has a booster organization. It's a private independent group called the Seminole Boosters. They had close to $250 million in assets last time I checked. They also help pay the university president's salary. They take care of, you know, legal fees sometimes when there are issues that come up involving athletes. So, you know, these booster organizations have a tremendous amount of influence and power. And I think many times universities kind of use them to do things that they don't want to dirty their hands with because they're not technically part of the university. They're nonprofit, independent groups. So I think that if you're going to take an overall look at what needs to be done to kind of, you know, change the way college sports is being run, they certainly are part of the equation.
Is there any stomach to change what we know of today as big-time college football and college athletics?
Well, that's a great question. And if there is, I'm not sure where it is. When you think about what would have to be done, for instance, to change the tax-exempt nature of college sports, it would literally take an act of Congress. And there's probably not a lot of political incentive there to take that on. College sports is a really popular pastime. And I found as an investigative reporter for the Times now for almost 15 years that outside of politics, you know, college sports probably engenders the most passionate, you know, opinions of almost any subject. And so, you know, there's not a lot of lot to be gained if you're somebody in a position of trying to change anything.
Well, as somebody who's covered college sports for now almost 40 years since I was in college, I would have to say that most of the participants do benefit in some way from the college experience, and most of them are productive citizens. So do we throw the baby out with the bathwater?
No, I think that, you know, you have to take a look at where most of these issues are concentrated. It certainly is not in the vast majority of student athletes or even vast majority of athletic programs. We're talking about the very top levels of the Division I, in which you have, you know, programs that are totally invested in you know, big money sports. And, you know, your average athlete is never going to make it to the pros. And so, you know, for them, the goal should be getting a decent education. Many of them are able to do that. But for the ones who, you know, have a shot at a professional career, they need to also be taken care of as well. And so, you know, they're not getting really a decent education in many instances. And if they're not able to, you know, make it in the NFL, the NBA, they have nothing to fall back on. So it's really kind of unfair to them.
Mike McIntyre is the guest. His book is Champions Way, Football Florida, and the Lost Soul of College Sports. Thank you so much for joining us, Mike McIntyre. We're back after this timeout on WRKF. This is Jim Engster, and we're joined now by Cynthia Levinson. She holds degrees from Wellesley and Harvard and also attended the Lyndon B. Johnson School of Public Affairs, the author of several books, and she's joined by Sanford Levinson, American legal scholar, professor of law, and the Department of Government at the University of Texas, and a frequent visiting professor at Harvard. He holds degrees from Duke, Stanford, and Harvard, so we have two extremely educated people here, and they are students of the Constitution, and that is the focus of their book, Fault Lines in the Constitution, the Framers, Their Fights, and the Flaws That Affect Us Today. Now, many of us hold the Constitution reverently, but you say that we're headed for a crisis. Let's begin with you, Sandy. Why are we headed for a constitutional crisis?
Fault lines, of course, refer to tectonic plates in the ocean or in the land. Most of the time, we live our lives very happily. I went to law school in California, and it was very pleasant. But we all knew that sooner or later, the big one might hit. The Constitution, I believe, has a number of fault lines. Much of the time, don't matter one way or the other, but on occasion can really generate terrible, terrible consequences. And so one of the things the book does is to focus on the fault lines and the problems that they can cause.
Well, we're talking about some things that are pertinent today. For example, gerrymandering. You believe that gerrymandering needs to be addressed. How could it be done constitutionally?
There's a deep paradox about either gerrymandering or gerrymandering. There's a debate about that, and we differ among ourselves. The importance of gerrymandering at the national level actually goes back to an 1842 law that Congress passed requiring single-member districts, and it made sense in 1842. But once you require exclusively single-member districts, you're inevitably going to tear your hair out about how to draw the single-member districts. From one perspective, the problem could be solved fairly easily if, for example, Congress in 2017-2018 passed a law saying that any state that had more than, let's say, half a dozen representatives would elect the representatives in districts of three or four or five by proportional representation. That would assure much more fairness in the actual process of representation, and it would by and large get rid of gerrymandering. The problem is that it's impossible to imagine that the House would pass such a law because they benefit from the gerrymandering. So you would need, unfortunately, a constitutional convention really to adopt this very sensible solution.
That's one approach. Another approach is for states to follow nonpartisan decision-making regarding how district lines are drawn. A number of states do that, and so rather than having elected members of state legislatures decide on who gets to vote for whom, or as we say in the book, allow Congress people to choose the people who vote for them, if there were nonpartisan commissions drawing district lines, then Gary or gerrymandering might also disappear, at least for partisan or racial reasons.
One of the items in the Constitution that has come into a lot of discussion in the last 20 years is the Electoral College, and your chapter is The College with No Courses or Credits. We've got a problem here is how it begins. Now, this is the only election in America where somebody can get more votes than the other person and not win. Why do we have this system?
The quick answer to that question is because in 1787 it made sense. We didn't have national parties, we didn't have national media, and in addition, there's also the dirty secret that the Electoral College was a way of giving slave states extra power. In 2017 or 2020, none of these make sense. We have national parties, we have national communications, people in California can get good information on who might be promising leaders coming out of New England or the Deep South or vice versa. We're stuck with it, even though since 1944, every poll taken about the Electoral College shows that a majority of the public would like to get rid of it, but we're stuck with it because of another thing we talk about in the book, which is Article 5, the amendment article. It's extraordinarily difficult to amend the Constitution. So although there have been 600 amendments offered to get rid of the Electoral College over many, many years, we still have it because it's nearly impossible to get the two-thirds of each House of Congress and then three-quarters of the states to accept it. Actually, it's never even gotten out of Congress.
And in fact, the same states that benefited initially, or those kinds of states, the small ones, don't want to relinquish the fact that they get two Electoral College members because they have two Senate members that they've always had. So they would be reluctant also to eliminate the Electoral College.
There's also the perverse fact that the so-called battleground states, think particularly of Ohio and Florida, may want to keep it because they make out like bandits every 4 years with promises from pandering candidates. My wife and I split our time between Texas and Massachusetts. And let me tell you, we really don't know that there's an election going on in some sense once fall comes because the candidates don't bother to come to Texas or Massachusetts. Where they are is Florida.
Yeah, we don't have the candidates campaigning in Los Angeles or San Francisco or Houston or Dallas or New York City or Chicago because those states are largely determined to be either red or blue and it's not going to change. They're not swing states. But you do point out a person could conceivably carry 11 states by narrow margins, those states being California, Texas, New York, Florida, Illinois, Pennsylvania, Ohio, Michigan, Georgia, North Carolina, and New Jersey.
Very good.
and win the election.
Yep.
Lose the
yes.
other 39 states and the District of Columbia, and they could win the election just by carrying these 11 states. Is that really the kind of system that is fair?
No. You're speaking to the choir. I think it's a crazy system. Even if we don't engage in founder bashing, so I'm willing to make the argument that it made sense in 1787. It's crazy today, but we're still stuck with it. And the remarkable thing is that even after 2000 and 2016, there's no serious debate about getting rid of the Electoral College because of Article 5. It just seems nearly impossible, though actually you should know that there is an organization called Fair Vote that's trying to encourage the 11 largest states, the one you mentioned, to pass legislation saying that they will instruct their electors to vote for whoever comes in first nationally. So this means Texas, had it agreed to this, would have voted for Hillary Clinton.
In the Electoral College.
Or California would have voted for Donald Trump had he gotten more votes, which he didn't. We aren't close to getting the number of states to adopt that who, in fact, have a majority of the Electoral College. But it would be so much simpler. There are problems with the Fair Vote proposal. It's not worth taking the time to go into them. It would be much more simple if we could simply abolish it through a constitutional amendment, have either a single national vote or a national vote with a runoff to make sure that whoever was elected president, in fact, had the support of a majority of the voters in a runoff. In Louisiana, you have runoffs if nobody gets a majority. In Georgia, they have runoffs. It's a sensible system.
Two of the last five elections for president have involved a candidate winning the popular vote and losing in the Electoral College, but both times it was the Democrat who won the overall vote and the Republican who won the presidency. But in 2004, it was almost the other way around, with John Kerry coming very close to winning Ohio, which would have made him the president despite
right.
losing the overall vote. Until this affects a Republican adversely, as it has two Democrats, is there really going to be any stomach for this as far as a constitutional change?
Yeah, that's a great question. And the only honest answer is we'll have to wait and see.
It would be interesting to see. One rather doubts it, but it's a good hypothetical.
As far as any basic constitutional changes beyond the ones we've discussed that need to be addressed, what should be on the front burner?
Literally right now, in terms of what I think is a basic constitutional problem, it's the fixed-term presidency. That is the four-year term. And the only way we can get rid of a president in the 4 years is through impeachment or through the 25th Amendment, which has never been used, where the cabinet, in effect, declares that the president is unfit to govern. Both of those have very, very real problems. It would be much more desirable if we had a process where Congress, say, by a two-thirds vote, could declare no confidence in a president, and the president would be forced out. Or, as you have in Wisconsin and California, the prospect of recall elections. I think one of the realities of the current situation is if you are opposed to Donald Trump, you nonetheless say, well, you know, we're stuck with him for 4 years. If you're for Donald Trump, you say, you know, good news, it really doesn't matter that he has the approval of only 36% of the people and that he is clearly losing support among congressional Republicans after the last several days, because the good news is that we're going to have him around for 4 years. And it seems to me this is something that we ought to be discussing.
Working with Sandy on this book, I came to realize the inherent injustice in giving every state, no matter its size, two senators. That affects not only legislation, it affects filibusters, it affects the Electoral College, it affects the budget. Now, I don't know that we should get rid of the Senate altogether, but one of the things we do in the book is propose alternatives. And there are alternatives to think about in terms of the composition of the Senate.
Well, we thank you for joining us today, Cynthia Levinson and Sandy Levinson. Their book is Fault Lines in the Constitution, The Framers, Their Fights, and the Flaws That Affect Us Today. Hope you have a great weekend, and we'll be back Monday. For Ali Baltazar, I'm Jim Inkster. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned.
For a podcast of today's show, go to WRKF.org or find the Talk Louisiana podcast on the WRKF app. We welcome your feedback and topic suggestions. Email us at talk@talklouisiana.org. Talk Louisiana is a production of WRKF in Baton Rouge.